everybody. Welcome. Welcome here to show 154 on Crypto Voices. Matthew Brzezinski is your host here from Eastern Europe, joined by my co-host Alec Harris from Halo Privacy and Eastern Seaboard US as always. Alec, what's going on?
What's up, fellas? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Good to see you. And we have a special guest today, Robert Malka, joining us from the Middle East, I believe. And we're very happy to have him on. He is an entrepreneur, author, a background in philosophy, and also a board member of the Bitcoin Today Coalition. So happy to have him on. Robert, thanks a lot for joining and welcome.
Yeah, always a pleasure. It's I connected with Alec at an event and we really hit it off. So I'm really grateful to be on here with you guys.
Yeah, great to meet you. You know, let's just jump into the to the foundation there. We have interviewed over the years on this show a couple of your board members, Jimmy Song, Amanda Cavalieri as well. And, you know, it's interesting for those of us in the space that have been paying attention long enough to foundations and Bitcoin in particular. They kind of have a checkered past. You know, the original Bitcoin Foundation had this interesting relationship with business, but that relationship turned out to be on the wrong side of the block size wars because of the you know, importance of keeping Bitcoin decentralized. And then actually in Riga, in my neck of the woods here in 2018, we had the B was announced, the Bitcoin Foundation was going to be headquartered in Liechtenstein. Elena Vranova, we actually had her on the show talking about that as well. That didn't get off the ground. A lot of Bitcoiners were pretty much against that. And there's obviously many foundations and many non-government organizations working on Bitcoin. Coin Center comes to mind. But when it comes to sort of a, when Bitcoin is in the name and it is a foundation, sometimes that can rub certain Bitcoiners the wrong way. I'm just curious, have you ever come across that? What have you guys developed with your organization to try to maybe to counter some of those narratives you know, shape yourselves?
Right. So to my mind, it seems to me that Bitcoiners can generally be divided into two categories. One is Bitcoiners who are determinedly apolitical and Bitcoiners who are determinedly political. And the theory on the apolitical side is that you're really, Bitcoin is just going to do its work. If you make it a political thing, it's really just, you know, some way or other, it will ultimately hold Bitcoin back. It'll be co-opted by people who, you know, I mean, it really just puts it in the emphasis of the wrong people. It creates possibly an attack vector. We're not necessarily interested in that. And the other side is something like, we really want to make sure that regulations in certain areas or as many areas as possible are warm to Bitcoin so that we can advance the narrative more easily. We can allow it to spread more quickly in a decentralized manner. Ultimately, top down could theoretically, right, obviously slow down Bitcoin. Whether it stops Bitcoin is another matter. We don't necessarily think that Bitcoin is really stoppable as an entity, but we do see that there is a tremendous advantage to rolling up our sleeves, getting in, getting into congressional offices, getting into the offices of regulators, and actually showing them that Bitcoin is relevant to their constituencies. And so, you know, we've taken that second route, and where the our goal is to be a Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin Today Coalition's goal is really to be in DC. We want to have a clear presence in DC. We want to create a strong orange pill narrative that crosses both parties, right, both sides of the aisle. And we want to be able to guide and direct bills and regulations in favor of a pro-Bitcoin country. And we think that will lead to a tremendous advantage. Have we really encountered serious resistance? I would say not really among Bitcoiners. I think actually we've gotten a lot of encouragement. A lot of people have been very warm to the idea in general of a political bent. And that it also, you know, our goal is to make the space feel very adult, right? I mean, up to this point, it's felt very much like, or, you know, in some years previous, it's felt very much like a bunch of us, there's been a lot of infighting, there've been a lot of problems. We want to be able to show up in suits and really, create a strong impression on the Hill, build relationships and do the work that really needs to be done. to create a force for Bitcoin and not necessarily crypto specifically. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's great. And it was a pleasure connecting with you, Robert, and shout out to Amanda for creating a venue for so many awesome folks. So what I wanted to ask here is, I think there is a perception that it might be easier, or there's a little more of a warm reception in the US on the right side of the aisle to Bitcoin. And we've seen a more permissive environment for mining in red states versus blue states. But I would also argue, if we're down to principles, which we rarely are, there's some blue side principles that are super aligned with Bitcoin fundamentals. So as you guys are trying to talk to both sides, right, what's that like? What's the dynamic like as you go left and right?
We have seen more skepticism on the left. We're not really sure why that is the case, as you say. Cryptocurrencies in general are much more popular with minorities than they are non-minorities. There's a reason for that, right? This lowers the ladder for people on people who don't nearly have as much money, who have lost out by making stagnant salaries over the last 50 or 60 years, to be able to advance, actually save money, actually develop a lower time preference, a longer time horizon to see a better future. So it is somewhat paradoxical that the blue states are less warm to it. The supposed attack, and the place where we get the most resistance is, as a lot of people will expect, around climate and energy. And I think we've been slowly advancing the notion of the fact that mining does not, in fact, take more energy, does not usurp. If anything, right? If you love ESG, you would love mining more. You would love the way it stabilizes grids. You would, right? I mean, we know the argument. I don't know if I need to go into it here, but actually getting that narrative to take place and to gel with the right people has taken us some time. We have seen some bright lights there. We have worked with Dems. We are seeing more Dems get warm to it. There is greater receptivity. There are a lot of staffers on the Hill, and I've been saying this, that there is reason to be optimistic. A lot of staffers know more about Bitcoin than you would think. The conversation is advancing very quickly. They are talking to each other. Both sides of the aisle are talking to each other. Of course, we have Senators Gillibrand and Lummis. There is some kind of bipartisan discussion. And we have a lot of faith that eventually an independent Dem narrative around Bitcoin that is pro-Bitcoin will sort of gain steam and run on its own. So we're really very optimistic about that.
Yeah, that's great, as am I. So on the Bitcoin Today Coalition website, you guys have some really great stats that my read on these stats is it's trying to show the democratization of Bitcoin, you know, lowercase d, right? Like a lot of people own Bitcoin and a lot of wallets are small holders. And notably, it says 22% of U.S. household or U.S. persons, I think, are Bitcoin owners. So, you know, that's really high, 1 in 5. So that means every elected official has a large constituency of hodlers, which is awesome. But do you still find that people see it as a niche group, or it's just the tech community, or it's just the anarchists, or it's just the, like, Bitcoin, I think, has been shedding some of those tropes, you know, the original one being it's just drug dealers, right? So we've really improved on all those. But as you're talking to the folks who are not engaged yet, and your first conversation, your sit down, what are they saying, right? Do they realize that a lot of their constituents are hodlers?
No, they haven't put together the numbers like that. And it also makes sense, right? When you speak to just your regular average Joe, what you get is something like, I have, you know, whatever, 1/8 of a Bitcoin and it's an investment. Something like that. Some very small number, as you say, and it's usually considered an investment and they hope it pays out. And their mentality is still taking Bitcoin, converting it back into fiat, right? Rather than seeing the fiat system a certain way and then seeing Bitcoin as maybe a way to save your money or over the long term or whatever other view they may want to take on Bitcoin that's a little more advanced than simply raw investment. So I mean, it makes sense. It's Bitcoin isn't seen as kind of a, it isn't seen as what it really is, right? A way to lift us out of a, you know, an inflationary currency that is effectively going to be worth zero someday, if it's not already. So it's not exactly discussed with staffers or discussed with representatives at that level. So they don't see, you know, the quantity doesn't quite translate into the potency or quality of the narrative there. So when we show up and we explain that and we explain what Bitcoin is going to be, there is an opening and they end up being interested because they do have this kind of sense that of everybody they know, there is some non-zero percentage that holds Bitcoin and it's in the media and people are taking it seriously. And every day the narrative gets more and more advanced. So I think, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of that's the orientation of the narrative at this point. That's where we're going. Yeah.
No, it does make sense. And I think it was Sun Tzu who said, quantity is its own quality. So maybe we just need everyone to be a hodler. So kind of one more question on this vein. You mentioned the demographic break. What about generational? So as we have more millennial elected officials and regulators, and we maybe have more Zoomer staffers and folks ascendant in these spaces, is that trend in our favor too?
I would say so. I think one of the things we've noticed when it comes to representatives actually is, you're right, the left-right divide is much more pronounced among boomer left and right rather than millennial or Zoomer left and right. So when you start to see millennials, it's actually very hard to tell who's a Dem and who's a Republican on the specific issue. It really is more age-based. And so it seems to me that within the next 10 years, I would say vast majority of representatives, I don't know about regulators, they're hard to swap out in a way, right? But when we talk about the congressional representatives in both houses, on both sides of the aisle, it seems to me that Bitcoin will become an accepted matter of fact way to understand and grapple with both economics and the welfare of this country, which I have tremendous faith in. So I think Bitcoin will really open doors for us in the next 10 years.
Yeah, kind of going along that, same line of thinking, every sort of older boomer, if you will, that gets into Bitcoin that I speak to, especially even over here in Europe, if they have a U.S. passport, because U.S. tax law is so draconian, you know, they might just go some share route, whether it's, a mining firm or even MSTR, just anything to get them exposure. They're like kind of interested. But they're also worried about sending Bitcoin around, which is a very boomer way to think about it, because of this draconian sort of setup that the U.S. has with taxes. And obviously, we know Bitcoin is for everyone. You can't control Bitcoin that can go somewhere from Taiwan to Africa or wherever. But the U.S. really wants to keep their securities law intact and everything else. So you can kind of go anywhere you want with that. But I am curious your guys' maybe policy position there, where the winds are blowing, because I think it is important to keep in mind that, there's a lot of young people coming up that are excited to use this technology. And it's just not, it's not only for hodlers or people that want to indirectly have exposure via some, SEC registered investment vehicle.
Right. Well, the good news is that Bitcoin is widely considered a commodity. I can't imagine that will change. So it's not going to be bracketed under securities tax laws, which is good. It seems to me that it'll probably be solidified as, if you sell your Bitcoin, you'll have to pay taxes on it. I wonder if that's how it'll play out. I would defer to probably Amanda for a more nuanced take on exactly how tax laws are going to play out. But as far as that being an attack vector, I think that's somewhat less likely. It seems to me that there are things like the Dame tax, an attempted tax on mining, which is being brushed aside. But I think that's sort of the greater worry in general. In broadly speaking, the attack vector has been tied to mining. I don't think it's been quite related to hodling Bitcoin in specific, even though you're expected to, announce your assets. You're expected to announce that you hold Bitcoin.
We don't have to pull the thread too much, but Bitcoin will, and it always does, increase as a circular type of economy. That might happen on a layer two, but it's still, it's going to be a Satoshi denominated thing, and that gets complicated. If it's as you correctly point out, it's still a commodity. or if it stays a commodity. We joke about it. Even Michelle, our French co-host, has joked about it with us. Like, you know, Americans just talk about taxes too much. And it's just one of these things. I mean, I don't know if there's thresholds or if there's like, you know, lower level limits where it won't apply. I mean, but, you know, Germany, they don't have any taxes on Bitcoin, at least if you hold it more than a year, for sure. Yeah, so it's just one of those things. I mean, like, I don't know if you want to, if you have any more on that, but it's, you know, if we want it to be a circular economy, we want it to be used. I do think it is something that the boomers need to think about more.
Yeah, we'll certainly be looking out for Senator Lummis's bill, which is going, you know, purported to have much greater understanding of how we want to break down taxes as it relates to Bitcoin and other digital assets in general. And we'll certainly be able to give a much more cohesive update as we approach that. And I think that's more or less all I would say about that at this time.
So let me shift a little from elected officials to regulators. We in the Bitcoin community are hyper aware of who Gary Gensler is. Unfortunately, like I wish I didn't know who he was. But so, and there's this sort of like, I don't know. At first, right, everyone's like, oh, great. He used to teach a class at MIT. He understands crypto. He understands Bitcoin. Then he comes in, you know, appears to be too close to SBF and FTX. And maybe there's a knee jerk. And who knows? You could pull a bunch of narrative threads. And I don't know what the truth is necessarily. And now we see the whole BlackRock and Charles Schwab, and Fidelity's always been in the space, but, you know, there's the big, big behemoth institutions, you know, trying to take a seat at the ETF table. So reading the winds, like, where is the SEC side of the regulatory trend headed? Do you have any thoughts there?
I'm laughing because we've had a lot of internal talks about this. The question is whether Gary Gensler is trying to close down on the assets he knows for a fact are securities. He includes Ethereum, right? Which is for the Ethereum community, that's very frustrating and very controversial, which I can understand. But when you switch to proof of stake, you make it much harder to make the argument that you're a commodity, in my mind. We can get into that. But although, you know, it's funny, there are a lot of discussions around sort of what a commodity is and the rights you have around an asset that's a commodity, right? And so there are offices that have a certain mind that they would say that Ethereum is a commodity because its rights, even through proof of stake, they actually remain fairly similar. The rights you have with Ethereum are fairly similar to the rights you have with Bitcoin, which I find that to be a whole interesting philosophical discussion on its own. But that being said, it seems to me that Gary Gensler might be wanting to do a kind of Trojan horse attack, if that's how we want to talk about it, whereby the on-ramps and off-ramps for other digital assets are basically closed off. And then he can isolate Bitcoin and he can eventually find ways to make it very difficult for exchanges to buy and sell Bitcoin, exchange Bitcoin. So that's... The question is whether that is the strategy or whether, you know, he's working in good faith. I mean, that's, you know, Gensler is this big question. Is he actually acting in good faith? Is he trying to find some genuine stability for the market? Because the volatility is understandably wild and can't continue. You can't just have SBFs taking $60 billion of American wealth and disappearing off with it to the Bahamas and then bribing a certain party with a whole bunch of money from that a whole percentage of that money. So you know, obviously stability is needed. And then there's also this, I'm trying to steel man his argument, right? That there is his hands were, he did obviously know SBF personally, and I'm just ignoring that for a second. He did have his hands tied behind his back insofar as SBF, FTX.us was the only website that the SEC was able to, had control over, had a say over, whereas FTX.com was not located in the United States. So, you know, how do you make sure that that kind of thing doesn't happen again? So having an application for every token, trying to slow down the buying and selling of these cryptocurrencies, I mean, that seems fair. That seems understandable. Again, is it a plan to sort of try to isolate Bitcoin and then make sure that exchanges one by one can no longer manage based on the burden of bureaucracy that he's going to demand of these entities, just no longer be able to sell, buy or sell anything really at all? It's up for grabs. Some of us are suspicious of his behavior in general. Probably a power play for Treasury, right? So we're not totally sure. I'm personally on the side of, it seems like this is just phase one of a longer choke point 2.0, 3.0, 4.0, whereby ultimately Bitcoin is not really bought or sold in the United States. But that just seems very hard to believe. I can't imagine even that red states would be okay with that. They would say, yeah, you can sell here, you can buy here. You know, I don't care what the federal government says. So there does seem to be a break in general between what the federal government says and what states want to do. And there's going to be a kind of regulatory war or feud all the while. You have entities like Dubai, you know, countries like Dubai. I'm sorry, countries like the United Arab Emirates, you know, Dubai, which is one state within the Emirates, finding an opening for crypto companies, right? Allowing them to work there. And that will, of course, advantage their economy in the short term, short and medium term. So we have a lot to lose from all of this feuding.
You know, you mentioned Ethereum, you mentioned Bitcoin there. Obviously, your organization is more focused towards Bitcoin, but it is kind of this full frontal attack on crypto is difficult to deal with as well. And I do, although I think, you know, we're all Bitcoiners first here for sure. Like, I'm not a fan of the, you know, let the SEC take down all of crypto, except for Bitcoin, because Bitcoin's a commodity. Like, that just doesn't right. seem like it's in the ethos or the spirit at all of what we're trying to do here. Do you have a general strategy there as far as other crypto assets, or is it mostly focused on Bitcoin?
Yeah, entirely focused on Bitcoin. We don't officially take any position on any other digital asset, right? In my mind, and I'm speaking personally and not on behalf of the coalition at this point, my thought is something like, it could very well be that other digital assets have uses that are genuinely applicable and necessary. There are things that come out of that space, like ZK proofs, right? Zero knowledge proofs. There are innovations that come out of that space. So the space is not all scammy, right? It's not all a bunch of SPFs. And Mashinsky's, right? There was a, yeah, that's right. So there is stuff coming out of the space. We don't take a position on any of it, and we let them kind of figure it out on their own. And our goal is just to back Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a very clear and very, you know, relatively speaking, modest goal. And we really, really believe in the goal of saving money, right? Of I don't mean saving money as in saving it in a proverbial bank. I mean actually saving the idea of a currency that can that can store value over time, be transacted anywhere on Earth, and so on. So that's our emphasis. That's our focus. Also, just makes it easier, right? Fewer vectors to respond to. It's just like, look, let's look at Bitcoin. Let's see how it works, and let's really explain it from top to bottom.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, Matt and I were talking a while ago, but there was a point when you could almost follow the whole industry. And you could kind of just know all the participants and all the threads. And it's far beyond that now, where you kind of have to, you know, pick something, right? So one more on the sort of politics line of questioning. We now clearly have Bitcoin as a presidential election topic, right? RFK Jr. has been asked about it. DeSantis has been asked about it. I'm sure the question will come up with other candidates. Just that is amazing, right? Just that's like something
insane
question you have to answer now. And a really good thing, right? And RFK Jr. and DeSantis both have really had kind of favorable comments, like fantastic comments on Bitcoin. So, you know, we're going to see, hopefully, we're going to see presidential debates, right? If you were a moderator, like what kind of question would you want to see them answer?
Yeah. Wow. It's great. I mean, I would try to keep it very broad and straightforward. Something like, what role do you see Bitcoin playing in the United States Treasury? Or what role do you see Bitcoin playing for the United States? I would even ask, right? Do you have any sense of how you would want to integrate Bitcoin and digital assets in general into a tax structure as an asset class? Or do you defer to Congress for that? If so, do you have any preferred bill that you hope passes? I think I would just keep it to those very simple questions and let them rip. RFK obviously spoke at Bitcoin Miami, you know, so there's an incredible alliance there. We have tremendous hope for the future. I mean, even Trump has had to respond to Bitcoin over the last few years, and obviously he's not a huge Bitcoiner. He likes the dollar. But I think there, you know, it's not mutually exclusive. It's not like it's Bitcoin or the dollar. It's that the dollar could be backed by Bitcoin. It's, you know, there are all kinds of ways to play this game. And it does seem to me that self-custody is not going to be for everyone. It does seem to me that there will continue to be intermediaries with Bitcoin over the years. And so why would you shrug away the role of the dollar when it could run on Bitcoin rails? You know, there are just all kinds of things that we could do. So it's really a very exciting future, and RFK very much seems to get it. And if you have both sides of the aisle talking about it like that, you're going to be able to see immediately who's against it. I mean, we're getting to a place now, right, where you're no longer going to be able to claim ignorance on Bitcoin. We're almost there. And then at that point, you're going to be able to see who's for it and who's against it and why. And you know, for example, that Brad Sherman understands Bitcoin. You know it. It's very obvious. There's no way the man doesn't get it, but he hates it. So Elizabeth Warren hates it. So that tells you what side of the aisle they're on insofar as you have a Bitcoin, anti-Bitcoin side of the aisle. And when you say anti-Bitcoin, you're probably meaning pro-bank. And I think that it's sort of all you need. Sort of all you need to say. Do you really need to say any more than pro-bank? And I think in that sense, while I'm not anti-bank, it does seem to me that banks will have to shift their role and play intermediaries in the Bitcoin network ecosystem and maybe even other digital assets in fresh ways. I think at this stage, almost saying being pro-bank is going to be mutually exclusive in the same way that at one point streaming music was mutually exclusive to record labels, right? That everybody expected you to buy music a certain way. And then LimeWire came about and eventually Spotify was born. So people shifted. This is just an adaptation that has to happen, and it's much delayed. The exchange of value just did not come in with the exchange of information. They just didn't follow the same. The revolutions didn't happen at the same time, right? The exchange of information with the internet had to happen, and then for some reason, Bitcoin took some time later, and that's okay.
Are you aware of the 402 error?
What is that? No, do tell. Yeah,
they had the 404 error, which was the page not found, the famous.
Right.
There was actually, I think Netscape came up to it. I asked Bill Barhide about this when we interviewed, because he was with Netscape, but he didn't have a story to it. So I still don't know exactly who exactly came up with it, but there is a 402 error payment not found. And they actually had it, but they, you know, just never caught on until now.
So is the goal to bring back the 402 error, except when you do that, you've wired $1 billion to the wrong address and it's gone forever.
Yeah, I think they couldn't envision the unstoppable, uncensorable version of payments that came with Bitcoin. But yeah, it's an interesting little history there.
Oh, nifty. Oh.
What do you make of the argument that if Bitcoin is successful, right, it undermines the US dollar, and then the US ability to project economic strength globally is cut off, right? You hear that, or that is at least kind of like an undercurrent to some of the, we can't let Bitcoin take up too much more. It can't be, you know, our new currency.
Right. Well, I say again, I really don't believe that Bitcoin and the dollar, Bitcoin will destroy the dollar. I just don't think that's what's going to happen. If anything, it gives us a geopolitical advantage relative to Russia and China, who are the other two great powers on the scene, right? And one is really trying to get the renminbi to be a thing in Africa and so on. It seems to me that we can't really project military power into Africa any longer. It seems to me that the United States can't logistically do what it did in World War II. When I think about how many divisions it was able to launch across the Atlantic, we can barely keep our roads together at this point. It seems to me that we are just not able to put together a serious military effort in the way that we used to. So we have to be very practical about what kinds of economic advantages or what kinds of cards we hold when we're dealing with other countries. And there will be countries that are mid to small size who are not going to want to interact with any of the three countries' currencies as their primary, will not want to tether it to any one of those. And when they make that decision, the thing they're going to go for is Bitcoin. So the question is, which countries are going to openly interact with Bitcoin and allow free trading to occur? And that's going to be the United States. So Russia and China are going to try to get you on their platforms, as it were. And the United States is going to say, look, we're the country of freedom. We would absolutely love to have you on the dollar. If you don't want to be tied to the dollar, tie yourself to Bitcoin. We'll navigate trade that way. Trade agreements. I mean, it just opens up all kinds of stuff. I think about the Middle East. I think about Qatar. And when they sell natural gas, settling payments takes time, but you can settle stuff instantly without SWIFT on Bitcoin, right? There are just all kinds of ways to do this. So they're of course trying to speed up payment settlement and so on and bring it into the 21st century, but it's already done with a money that doesn't tether them to any other country's political agenda. So that's pretty hard to beat if you're a smaller or mid-sized country, particularly ones that are extremely wealthy with basically a money printer coming straight out of the ground, like Qatar or Saudi Arabia. So I let alone El Salvador, which has much, much smaller set of resources to pull from than those two countries respectively. So that it seems to me that's kind of how I think that's how it will geopolitically play out. If we're smart, we'll use Bitcoin to our advantage when it comes to these other countries.
And what are your scenarios to, keep the dollar in some sort of hegemonic position alongside Bitcoin? Do you guys work on that, or do you talk with them about it, how they can utilize Bitcoin but still have the dollar if they really want to?
There's so much to break down there. It's a troubling question because, how did we have it before? We had full military ownership of the world at one point. We really took over the world. We just can't do that anymore. The petrodollar was just an extended effort to keep the party going. I think one of the things that I would like to see, the United States is probably the wealthiest country minerally of any country pound for pound. I think we have more than just about anybody. We have incredible rare earth minerals. Russia and China, of course, have those in spades, but so do we. And I would like to see the United States be able to export those assets. I'll say this for sure. One way you keep hegemony is not by needing to rely on people you could end up going to war with, for sure, right? So China produces Taiwan produces 80-90% of all chips in all computers in the world. It's 80-90%, and our effort is very minor compared to that. And China could take Taiwan. So then what would we do if that happened? So, that's one way to lose hegemony. I don't know if there's a way per se to keep hegemony. It'll probably really just be divvied up into regional power. So if we really keep a strong hand, we get North and South America, we get parts of Europe, right? Europe is still loyal. We just get Europe in general. And then Russia gets its sphere of influence, China gets its sphere of influence. And I don't know what happens to Africa. Africa could be more up for grabs than it seems. I don't know if global hegemony is sustainable at this point. We may have to adjust in the short term in order to see how things fall into place in 20, 30 years. It's a really bleak picture. But I just don't, I think we could be rah-rah as much as we want, but the United States has so many internal troubles that it will just take some time for us to resolve them. Not the least of which is crumbling infrastructure, kids who prefer to be influencers rather than plumbers. They're just, our core assets are disappearing. It'll just take 20 years to bring all that back. I don't know. It's a really shitty way to look at the situation. I just don't, you know, I don't see like, right. If we take a step back and we look at this in a broader way, we say that innovation has been declining in general since the 19th century. So if you can measure that from in a couple ways, right? You can say how many new words are being put out in academia? How many new terms, new ideas are being published? So you can actually just look at how the frequency of certain words over an entire space. And what you should see is a bunch of new terminology cropping up, but we don't see that anymore. We actually see a lot of terms being used over and over again. So actually our academia is stagnant. Academics are stagnant, our innovation is stagnant. If you look at the way venture capitalists look at projects, they go, what's the next Instagram? They're still thinking about things in terms of the way things used to be. We're not really innovating, seriously. We're not making much progress. If you look between the first iPhone and the 15th, I still have the very first iPod Touch. I can't tell the difference between that iPod Touch and the new iPhone. I have no damn idea what the difference is. So we're really just stuck. We haven't created space for innovators to really succeed. And just recreating those spaces so that we're, I mean, you know, like, could the inventor of the screw be born today? And I say that with seriousness. I mean, imagine like a life without air conditioning, a life without the screw, without certain of these fundamentals. Like, we don't even have machinists. So sorry for this very long rant or ramble, but I just think it will just take some time to bring that kind of climate back. And this is a global problem, right? This isn't just an American problem. It's just going to come down to the kind of world that we create. Boy, I'm sorry, this got really dark. I should just stop talking.
No, it's all right. It's part of podcasting, right? As we pursue these threads.
That was a more pessimistic view, but I also know, but no, I know from having spoken to you and you have a certain, well, you have a background in philosophy, right? And it's almost impossible to devote your life to Bitcoin the way you have without like a deep optimism too, right? Like Bitcoin without optimism, you're missing the point, right? And so like, what's the sunnier vision for the future?
Right. So as part of the reason why we're in the world that we're in is because invention and innovation takes time. It takes, you know, genius takes time to build. It's not just born out of nowhere. It's not something you order at a fast food restaurant, right? So the beauty of Bitcoin is the nature of its lowering, natural lowering of time preference. Every Bitcoiner started out in this fiat mentality, get rich quick, get in, get out. I want to get here as fast as possible. I want to get here as fast as possible. And then you start to see the people who've been in Bitcoin for longer periods of time actually end up saying, they calm down and they say, things will come. I mean, it could take 5 years, it could take 10, it could take 100, but my world will be built. You know, this vision that I have for the world will come. It's not exactly a rush. So I really believe in that vision deeply. I believe in this idea of a deflationary currency. I believe in the idea of a money that people can really invest in, forget about, and hand off to their kids. There's no chance of anybody taking it. There is no real estate tax, or I'm sorry, estate tax that can just take somebody's money the way a home could be taken, for example. So when you realize that, when it really clicks for you, you start to have a vision beyond yourself. And that's where Bitcoin becomes incredibly exciting. When you think that it's not just me, and not just my kids, but my grandkids and my great grandkids who could inherit and benefit from this world, and that they wouldn't want to spend it because they understand this fundamental idea that I worked 8 hours, and actually because I saved, it's now worth 16 or 24 in the future. Whereas today, right, when I work 8 hours, tomorrow it will probably be worth 7 or 6 or 5. And again, I worked those hours. There's no reason why that money should be worth less. And so when it is worth less, I'm incentivized to spend it to get that pleasure now, to get whatever it is I want now. So it's impossible to build a future if that's all you're thinking about, if the stress of your money being worth less, unconsciously, whether you know that by instinct or having thought it through, you know, it's just not worth it to save. So a lower time preference ends up opening the door to this very deeply beautiful world whereby people actually begin to not just have hope, but the will to implement it, the will to put it together. And so you start to see these kinds of overlaps between what Bitcoiners do and what they believe in, right? Many of them start to work out, they lose weight, they eat a certain kind of way. It's almost like a stereotype at this point, almost a meme, but there's something to that. And while I don't think every person who ends up using Bitcoin in the future will come to feel this way, I think the notion of lower time preference will spread and people will do kind of what the Japanese end up doing, which is save. They spend less, they save more. They're not going to worry as much about GDP. They're going to begin to store energy within their communities rather than throw it out, disperse it everywhere. And I think that has there is a deeply optimistic hue to that. But I think it takes time. And I think you can't have a party for 100 years, right? I mean, from really, I guess you could say technically from 1918 onward, but 1945 for sure, having us be the dominant power in the world and not have some consequences to that fiat party in the end. And obviously other countries have unfortunately suffered the consequences of that. And I think we're going to have a little bump. And then I think in 100 years, the United States will be the foremost power of the world. I think it will remain that way. So I guess that's all that's to say that I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah, agreed. So one of the things I think is a poor incentive structure is these artificial intervals that we have created. So whether it's a 4-year election cycle, a 2-year election cycle, quarterly earnings, right? Raising every year from venture, like whatever it is that puts us on this short, like I need to achieve X in a certain period of time in order to get into the next interval. And it disincentivizes a long arc of why don't I build something that's going to be a 10-year build or even like, you know, generational cycles and the types of projects that come from that, right? Like putting the man on the moon wasn't a quarterly earnings driven. I mean, I know it was a government project, right? But like that was a long arc. We need to do this, you know, for mankind type of thing. And so your comments on time preference, right? I think that's actually really important. And so if we can see a generational shift into longer arc efforts, that would be awesome. But what I wanted to ask you about, and I know you're not on the leadership committee for the work that the coalition is doing called BTC Vets. I think that's a really interesting intersection. And you have an intelligence community rep and a soft community rep and veterans. So can you speak a little to that effort?
I can. So there, BTC Vets is led by Kyle Schneps, Jason Browder, and Alex Brammer. Really, really incredible resumes and incredible people. And they are working on building a grassroots coalition of vets who are also deeply invested in Bitcoin. And they understand Bitcoin to be a national security issue, right? In the same way that our economic affairs is a national security issue. Bad economy means we are unable to protect ourselves and our allies. So, and of course, a failing money, if you consider the dollar to be a failing money, which you may or may not, right? But I do think that the central bank creates a lot of problems, as we saw in 08, and as we may end up seeing again, who knows? So they're deeply invested in orange pilling the community, the intelligence community, and also, I mean, making it available to legislators and regulators. I can't say that we are working on a book, and we're interested in bringing that book out. So, you know, certainly we'll do more updates as we get closer. But the great expectation is that we bring a deeper dialogue to. I mean, there really hasn't been much dialogue yet. Outside of Major Lowry, of course, who has really brought some interesting thoughts to the discussion. Very, very interesting thoughts. So really, really connecting those two worlds. So Bitcoin and national security all together, and then making that available both to lay people, to legislators, to regulators, and to the intelligence and military communities.
Let me attack this. I think this is awesome, right? This is actually very aligned with my personal beliefs, but people see intelligence community and Bitcoin, and we take what we know of like the CIA, right? And has been, you know, a force in many ways, like over the years. And so the connection between like, is Bitcoin an offensive tool for national security, right? Is it used offensively by the military, by the intelligence community? I assume that's not what this is about, right? But what would you say to that argument?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's both an offensive and a defensive tool. Again, offensive in the sense that if you sell Bitcoin as a freedom money, which it is, then every country that begins to use it also allies with the United States. That's an incredible, you know, no bombs have to be dropped. No bullets have to be used. Done. End of story. That's an incredible offensive tool. It's both censorship resistant on Lightning side, and it's both, you know, it's pseudonymous and accessible on the base layer. So you really get a bit of everything. So you're able to grant autonomy to states and their peoples without having to put a strong hand over it. That means less overhead from us. That means fewer problems, more trust, more transparency. There are a whole lot of there are implications to the Bitcoin universe that we can't even fully think through yet, and they really excite me. So I think they're doing incredible work, awesome. Particularly in the offense against China. I mean, again, China's not letting any of their money leave. They want full control over the spending that their citizens have. I just don't imagine that that's going to end well. Whereas when we've had freedom to spend, you know, freedom of money, we've always done better than our allies or enemies, whichever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Well said. Is, let's say, the CIA using, if the CIA was using Bitcoin to further their capabilities for clandestine operations, is that a good use of Bitcoin?
I'm trying not to give the political answer and say that Bitcoin is for everyone. I may be forced to just say that. I don't take a position in any direction. Do I like clandestine operations? No, but I also don't know what they are, so I'm kind of stuck. I think Kyle Schneps, who was formerly intelligence, would be able to speak to that question very effectively. I may ask him after this podcast what he would say. But we'll I'd to like to on. Say that. Yeah, right. Yeah, totally. I would like to say that it's a step up. I would like to.
I always say, right, like if you want something like cryptography to be available to everyone or Bitcoin to be available to everyone, you can't say it's available to everyone, but the government can't have it, right? Like, it's just available to everyone. And so if we don't want the government to be gatekeeper to us, but that same principle has to be universally true in the reverse.
That's right. That's right.
In my opinion.
That's right. Well, I mean, that's part of the way communism is so alluring because it's a philosophy of vengeance, right? It says that you can't, you know, you guys always made sure I couldn't have it. Now I get to have it and you don't. That's fundamentally all communism is. And so you're right. This is the other great thing about Bitcoin. It has no vengeance to it. Doesn't care who you are. Doesn't care what you do. Doesn't care what you're about. Doesn't care what your philosophies are. You get to use it. You're free. You're a free man. And so, or woman, or whatever. Right? Aliens can use it. It just really doesn't matter. Whereas communism always tries to put a hold on its people, and it tries to say the people can use it and the government can, or this group can use it and they can't, and it doesn't fly. Just philosophically, it's not coherent, it's not consistent. So anything that's based in vengeance is not trustworthy fundamentally. And so while the converse isn't, the corollary isn't necessarily true, I would say that for sure in this case it is true. Bitcoin is fundamentally trustworthy because it is so fundamentally neutral and accessible. That's what a money is supposed to be.
Couldn't agree more with that. I mean, living here in former Soviet Union, it's these lessons are always top of mind. And actually, you know, wanted to ask you about the philosophical, your philosophical background. And you mentioned at the very top of the interview how the party that is, I don't know, supposedly more philosophical and always for all human rights, the left, doesn't seem to get Bitcoin, and you weren't quite sure about why that is. And I agree. Do you find any other areas of, I don't know, modern philosophy that are looking into this new technology as a way to actually change the world? Maybe if it's not even something that, you know, the hardcore capitalist, anarcho-capitalist think about it, but in just in a different way, I don't know, just from a philosophical side.
Yeah, well, first things first is Bitcoin is actually not very new philosophically. It's not new at all. This has been around for quite a while. Austrian economics, right, starts with Smith, diverges into von Mises, I can never say his name right, but eventually into Hayek, Friedman, and they're eventually, right, so Smith is this foundation, and, you know, I actually really like Smith very much. I find him to be incredibly interesting, but Marx takes, I guess I could go into a little bit, Smith sort of sees an economy as being divisible into three primary economic classes. Right, there's the peasantry, there's the aristocracy, and then there's, I can't remember if it's called the gentry, but basically there's this middle class that balances things out. And then Marx gets rid of that middle third class, and he just says that everything is a diametrical opposition, that everything is antithesis, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. He just borrows from Hegel, blah, blah, blah. And then, right, Marx creates one economic path, and then the Austrians create another economic path. And so Marx's path ends up leading to the central bank. But the Austrians only had a philosophy and no ammo to respond to the central bank for some time. There was just no way to do it. They said gold, so everybody was a gold bug, but gold was still confiscatable. It wasn't purely Austrian. And then one day, of course, Bitcoin comes about. So the other way I phrase Bitcoin to econ nerds is that it's the first true application of Austrian economics to this century that we've had of Keynesian. And I think that makes it kind of interesting. Like, you actually are seeing, as is the case with all history and politics, you're seeing philosophy kind of clash on the battlefield. And you're starting to see why it is that the central bank has trouble against real, genuine Austrian economics, right? They can hoard all the gold they want. They can even hoard all the Bitcoin they want, but that still doesn't hold us back from having Bitcoin. You know, in theory, it shouldn't have held us back from having gold, but there you go. Executive orders galore. So I don't know. I think that's the easiest way to put it is it's not new. This was an egg that was hatched a very long time ago. And it just finally started to, I'm mixing metaphors here, it started to flower. I don't know, it started to become a chicken in 2009.
Yeah, indeed. And regarding the gold part, I mean, I actually just gave a speech about this at BTC Prague, probably give another variant at Honey Badger in Riga. The most swift, direct way that gold was stolen by tyrants during World War II, primarily Hitler, was just walking into the central bank and taking it. I mean, it was about an 80-20 split, you know, I mean, not morally equivocating, like the worst of the gold, you know, that the Tsan gold, as it was called, or like taking it from individuals as they were being marched to their death was just the most despicable, obviously. But the vast majority was just taken by walking into the central bank. And I think there's a lot of lessons there, actually, if you're talking about, you know, a nation's treasure. Storing, you know, a nation's wealth might not be such a good idea to have it all in one place. Talked about the Polish gold has had a remarkable journey all the way from, you know, when Hitler invaded in September 1939, had a remarkable journey down through Romania and the Black Sea and through the Mediterranean, and then the Nazis invaded France, where it eventually was, and all the way to America. But anyway, it's a little bit of a tangent there, but I totally empathize with your point that, like, it was kind of this philosophical, especially from the Austrian side, it was just this philosophical thing, like, well, okay, what's going to be gold is the freedom money, but that was very confiscatable, and that was indeed, I think, one of the core problems of it. So I think that's totally true when it comes to what Bitcoin can offer everyone.
Right. Helps also that you know, it's infinitely divisible and sendable and so on, so we didn't need the I find it interesting. I think about this fairly often. Gold had its own death and it's, you know, inherent to it. That is to say, it was such a problem to carry that at first people wanted silver, and then eventually we were like, no, let's just use paper. We can mass produce paper. Let's use paper. So gold killed itself. And the question is there any way in which Bitcoin could truly kill itself in that way? And it took, you know, gold has died several times, and I mean died in a very legitimate sense. That is, that kings would often inflate gold by mixing it with other metals and so on. And while that doesn't kill the idea of gold, it certainly killed its usage for people when they were no longer able to use an official minted coin with 100% gold in it or 99.9. It became 30, 20, 10, and then, you know, whatever, zero. So the question is, you know, can Bitcoin, is something like that possible for Bitcoin? And so far my answer is absolutely not, right? We've been looking at it every which way. We, you know, there are a number of us who, you know, are looking for that way to fail so that we can get out if it does, but we just don't see it, right? We're incredible optimists because we've all tried, we've all looked at it, and we've been like, this is not something that's capable of really failing. And so our faith in it is tremendous, and our love for it is tremendous. Our belief in what it could do for the world is tremendous. So in a way, you know, you almost have to be the biggest coward or the biggest skeptic, something like what Napoleon said about war. I'm the big greatest coward. I never want to send my soldiers into any battle. And he always won as a result. So we have done the, you know, I think Bitcoiners in general have done a lot of that thinking. So I think that's really the root of the optimism. Bitcoin is also unkillable. And if you believe the number, it's died like, what, 471 times supposedly, and it hasn't died yet. So, yeah.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, that's a great way to end it. Listen, Robert, just one more before we close it. I was reading, both of your parents are deaf, and you are writing a book about that.
That's right. The book will be released fairly soon. I'm very excited to send it to you guys. I would love to get your feedback when it's ready.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts about that? I mean, that's just, that's an amazing story.
Yeah. Yeah. Very challenging. I think insofar as it relates to Bitcoin, sign language interpreting is a skill. It is a skill for sure. That's not where the sentence was meant to end. It's very helpful to be able to take one idea and translate it or interpret it into another language or for another person so that it's salient. It's very clear. And I've learned that that's not easy to do. And to be good at that, even in one language, is very hard, right? The ELI-5, explain like I'm five, this idea or that idea is very challenging. So it's been a nice skill with staffers and regulators and legislators to be able to try to explain Bitcoin in whatever angle they need it to be understood. So insofar as it's relevant. But I would say in general, as far as life goes, having to sign it and interpret for your parents when you're very young is very challenging. I learned a lot, and probably for another cast, but yeah, it's challenging and rewarding in its own way.
Yeah, it's amazing. I definitely look forward to your book, and yeah, look forward to seeing what else you guys will be coming up with in your endeavors. So yeah, as we close it, listen, thanks a lot for joining us. Any links, any places our listeners and viewers should go to find out more about what you're doing?
Yeah, please check out BitcoinTodayCoalition.org. You're free to email me anytime, robert@BitcoinTodayCoalition.org, if you like. I would love to chat. You can also check out my website at malkarobert.com, so M-A-L-K-A, and then robert.com, no dashes, no spaces, anything like that.
We'll link to all of it. Robert, pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, man. Great to see you.
Ditto, Alex. Thanks. Bye, guys.